The Rufus Project would like to advise the following podcast contains spoilers for Gods of Egypt from 2016. If you do not wish to have this movie spoilt, please watch it before listening to the following podcast. Is it an epic classic of godlike heroes, or will it take a god to save it? We watched Gods of Egypt from 2016 to see if we could redeem it. Were we successful? Find out after the theme.
Boy? Oh boy.
Is it too good to be bad? So bad it's good. What's this movie? Do you think we should? It's got bad I love, dodgy creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy?
Hello and welcome to the Rufus Project Redeeming Features cast, this time looking at Gods of Egypt from 2016. My choice, and I am Trevor Holland, and I am joined by my good friend and co-host,
Christian Fletcher. And I noticed a bit of a shudder there, Trevor, when you mentioned that, but yes, we will take it on board that this was your suggestion, so without giving anything away early at all. So, I was willing to give this a go, and surprisingly you say 2016 and I virtually have no recollection of hearing about this movie.
Well, how could you not? Apparently it was an Australian production, which I'll cover on a bit later on as well. That was a big surprise that I had when I found that out. I was looking at Google Play the other day and it came up with a list of Australian movies that you can watch, and Gods of Egypt was first and foremost on the list. I'm going, what?
Oh, interesting connection. But yeah, I think I did look up that it was filmed mainly in Sydney and around Centennial Park. There's a few parts where you can kind of tell, possibly, aside from all the CGI and green screen. But I thought that was quite interesting. But I can tell that a lot of it was probably studio bound as well, but probably Fox Studios, I'm sure.
Now, if anyone out there has seen Gods of Egypt, like Christian, I do have a bit of a synopsis here so you know what we're talking about. Mortal hero Bek teams up with the god Horus in alliance against Set, the merciless god of darkness, who has usurped Egypt's throne, plunging the once peaceful and prosperous empire into chaos and conflict.
You do realise these plot summaries need to have your voice, Trevor, and the way that you say it, because it does it justice. but I suppose that sums it up quite well. And from somebody who studied a lot of ancient history, and I actually went through a stage where I wanted to be an Egyptologist. Ooh. So, this sort of stuff does interest me, or did interest me a lot. And I was digging through my mind a lot to see if, the mythology was true, and I think I even looked to see if it was based on a video game or something, like what made this film come about when it did. So I thought you may know a bit more, Trevor.
Yeah, I know. I think there was a mobile game that came out to support the movie, but that's about it for the game connection. I didn't even look up that myself, to tell you the truth. But again, we shall discuss this further. But before we get too much into the nitty-gritty and the bits and pieces, I think we should talk about the awards, both nominations, and believe it or not, this did win an award. So the Australian Academy of Cinema and Television Arts, it was nominated for Best Sound, Best Music, Best Costume Designs, Best Effect, and Best Hair and Makeup. The Film Critics Circle of Australia Awards had it nominated for Best Music. It got nominated for the Best Trailer at the Golden Trailer Awards. Then we've got the Houston Film Critics Society, who nominated it for their Worst Picture. The good old Razzies make an appearance. Didn't win any, but it was nominated for Worst Picture, Worst Actor for Gerard Butler, Worst Screen Combo for anytime two characters were on screen together, Worst Director and Worst Screenplay. But it did win something at the All Deaf Movie Awards, and it won the award for most out-of-place white person in a movie.
And who was that?
Sorry, it didn't say.
And who was that? Gerard Butler.
I think maybe any white person in this movie probably
Oh God. And it's interesting, in a bit of my research, I saw that this film actually copped a bit of slack. And I remember, I don't know if it was at this year's Academy Awards, it might have actually been last year and timed with this, but Will Smith or a lot of other actors were very vocal with the essential, you know, what they call whitewashing and not casting a lot of black actors in movies. And I believe Gods of Egypt was one of the movies sort of at the brunt of this controversy.
Yeah, yeah, yes, indeed. I mean, again, something I'm sure we will touch on. Maybe even in the Turkey trivia. We'll start by talking Turkey, about this potential Turkey. Who knows? It's actually got an IMDb rating of 5.4 out of 10. It had a budget of $140 million, and its box office takings were $142 million. Woohoo!
And as we know, with promotion, it's usually double, but I don't know if they would have, as I said, I didn't hear about it, so it was obviously wasn't promoted well enough. But, yeah, gosh, that, you know, is a big fail, I suppose, but still lucky to generate, you know, $140 million, but I'm sure it was probably just a strong opening weekend.
Now, trivia-wise, we did mention the whole whitewashing, because one of the things a lot of people were saying about a movie called Gods of Egypt was the fact that the film featured no Egyptian actors.
Ah, which is interesting. And I was also thinking, too, you know, Egyptian people are, you know, let's just say a bit darker in skin colour, so there definitely wasn't many of those.
No, no, certainly not amongst the main cast. Now, this was filmed in the Australian desert, though, after they figured they actually were planning to film in the Sahara, but that was considered too dangerous.
Or if in doubt, we'll just go to Australia instead.
Yeah, yeah. Mind you, I think one of the reasons I went to Australia, because apparently the production company Lionsgate and Summit, their exposure on the production budget of $140 million was only about $10 million, because they were able to recoup most of the budget via international pre-sales and Australian tax incentives.
Ah, so there was, yeah, other incentives for them to do that. So, and that's the thing, like, you know, I always wonder when I see people like Jeffrey Rush, and I, you know, go, oh, wow. And then I go, well, of course, you know, being an Australian film too, it sort of goes with the territory.
Yeah, and Brian Brown also turning up at the start.
Oh,
yeah,
definitely.
It was nice to see him.
I was so... Yeah, I was actually really surprised. Yeah, definitely surprised to see him. And not to give too much away, but I think he was very underutilized, let's just say.
Well, considering what happens to him, he couldn't do much after the opening.
That's the thing. After the opening, there's not really much more for him to do. But anyway.
Very, very true.
Stepping ahead of myself.
Right. Now, on to our nominated Worst Actor Razzie performer, Gerard Butler. Apparently he said that as soon as he read the word God in the script to describe his character, he knew he would have to embark on a huge bodybuilding process. He said he started his workouts immediately because he plays a god in the film and wanted to make sure he looked like one by the time shooting began.
I don't know whether that's method acting or egotistical. It's really quite hard to know. But when it's quite funny, considering a lot of the... Okay, fair enough, he looks quite fit in it, but a lot of the action-y sort of parts and, you know, when he transforms, you know, wouldn't be utilising much of his actual body. He would have been using effects, so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure we'll talk about the CGI bodies with the live-action heads at some point. Always a good look.
I don't know if I'm stepping on toes, but yeah, aside from, you know, we mentioned Gerard Butler and Jeffrey Rush, it was virtually unknown leads to me in actors in the lead roles. So, but sorry, that's probably touching on what you were going to say.
No, that's all good. Now, we've already mentioned the whole whitewashing controversy and no Egyptian actors. So when this film was criticized for casting mostly Caucasian actors, the director and the production companies issued separate apologies for doing so.
Not we're going to withdraw the movie. We're just going to send an apology and keep going.
Yeah, like, hey, we spent $140 million. True, we've got $130 million of that back due to various bits and pieces, but still, soz.
Yeah, yeah. And it's also, too, a very much an example of them sort of, you know, how, you know, what's a cultural appropriation? Like, you know, Americans taking an Egyptian tale, essentially, and making it completely American, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I can understand where they're coming from. But yeah, not being too familiar with the sword and sandal epic, which is funny. As soon as I, you know, see movies like that, I lump them into this category. Not knowing too much about this genre, I, you know, just let it happen and see what unfolded.
Yeah, very true. Very, very true. Because it had been a while, I think, between sword and sandal epics with Gods of Egypt. I mean, I suppose technically Prince of Persia may have been a sword and sandal epic that we could put in that category. I'm thinking of movies that we have watched for the podcast.
Yeah, well, it's funny you say that because I've got in my notes here we're in Prince of Persia territory again. It even felt a bit like Harem Scarum, the Elvis movie, in some parts as well. Oh my God, that's probably too loose of a connection, but anyway.
it works for me. So what we shall do is we'll move on, and this is the Redeeming Features cast, where we take a movie of questionable quality and have a look to see if we can redeem it. So we've got to set a baseline. So I've been to Amazon to get an idea of what we're working from. Now, this review is titled, "I literally said this is going to be the worst movie ever. I begged my fiance not to buy this movie. I literally said this is going to be the worst movie ever, and we are wasting $17. But alas, he had to witness for himself the awfulness that is Gods of Egypt. I love the tacky movies. I love the underworlds and the 300s of this world. But sweet Lord Almighty, this movie needs to be unfilmed now." 1 star.
I must admit, someone who's used the word unfilmed is, yeah, that's kind of quirky. But yeah, maybe, dude, you probably shouldn't have spent your $17 and maybe hired instead. He would have been less bitter. But yeah, as you said, Trevor, we have to have a baseline, so it can go any way from here.
Absolutely. Well, I'll tell you what, though, a movie that clocks in just over 2 hours, and this time I've only got myself to blame.
I know. And you know what, Trevor? It just means I've got more leverage for the next movie. But we will move on from that. But yeah, and usually with as somebody who has quite a short attention span, I usually wonder how a movie can be longer than 2 hours. But, you know, not to jump too far ahead, when you work out the last 10 minutes of the movie as credits, makes things a little easier, let's just say.
Yeah.
Even though knowing we have to watch all the way through.
Well, you say in the last 10 minutes is credits, but normally with these longer movies, they usually have longer opening credits too. But after those pyramids turned into mountains for the studio logo, it started very, very quickly. It was like...
Oh, very quickly. And I know we always talk about, I suppose, the typical narrator scroll or the narration, and this didn't hold back by giving us a bit of a recap. And and as we find out, it's the character of Beck that's speaking. But there's something about his narration that just doesn't seem to work. I kind of wanted this sort of warm narrator sound. It just didn't work for me. Let's just say the tone of the voice. Is this me being really critical?
Yeah. Well, when you consider the style of the narration was trying to be very refined and very sophisticated, and then the actual character of Beck was just this, you know, wild-eyed, jump-around, totally irresponsible thief guy. Not only did you have this disconnect between the narrator and the actual character on screen, also the fact that he was named Beck kept distracting me.
That's funny. Well, you know, obviously Beck being the 90s star, I must admit there were some times in the movie where I felt like singing, you know, "I'm a mortal baby, why don't you kill me?"
There was times...
it seemed quite appropriate.
There was times when I thought the song Loser may have also been quite appropriate just in its original state, but we shall cover that later.
But I might add, it is one of those movies where it almost takes you halfway through the movie to be able to jot down, oh, okay, that's the name of that character.
Yeah.
You know, especially with the character of Beck and his girlfriend, I suppose, Zaya, which is a interesting name. I could half expect people calling their kids that name nowadays anyway.
Yeah. I would not be surprised to see a few Zayas around the place, but not based on this movie. Zaya was certainly very, shall we say, prominent with her plunging necklines.
Definitely. And there's always a problem with watching films that are supposed to be, I suppose, you know, showing this particular period or this mythology. It just can't help. And I notice this a lot in it. It just can't help but have that modern feel about it that you think, ooh, I don't really think they would have said that or worn that. But you just sort of have to try and suspend disbelief. But it can be very hard with movies like this, especially when it's so thrown in your face.
Yeah, well, you're saying they wouldn't say that Straight up, the dialogue in this movie, it did not take very long to start getting to me. Really, the way things are said, I don't think mortal or God would talk that way. I mean, they weren't skipping on the grandeur for sure. I mean, everything was set in these huge open CGI areas, which huge CGI crowds and lots of music and pomp and ceremony, and then they started talking, and it's like, please stop talking. Or just say what you want to say.
It's like they obviously don't know. Yeah, it's hard for them to... They want to make it relatable, obviously, for a mainstream audience to go and watch this film. But yeah, a few lines, you know, there's a line later on, and sorry to jump ahead, but I have to say this. There's a line where he says, get off your ass and go get some water or something like that. And you just think to yourself, ooh, would they have really said ass?
Yeah.
I don't know.
I mean, and that's exactly right. Like, when they're actually having general conversations, it is so convoluted, and they're obviously trying to be so clever with the dialogue, but then they turn around and have a line like that. You're sort of going, that doesn't seem to match what was happening before.
Let's just say, as somebody who's tried to write scripts, dialogue is actually really hard to write, but I still look at this and go, oh, it just comes across like a lot of... They're trying to do a lot of wee one-liners. I obviously remember Dr. Freeze from Batman and Robin. It just seems like every line is supposed to be something that's going to be put on a T-shirt.
Yeah. I mean, there's just all sorts of things. Like, there's a great conversation. I've just looked up some quotes here now where Jeffrey Rush's Raj is going, Egypt has always been a paradise, but now there is chaos. God of the air, you must protect the mortals. Horus, I don't know if I'm strong enough. Ra, then become stronger. That was a dialogue. I'm not going to quote anymore because I'm looking down this list thinking if I quote more, I'm just going to get angry about the dialogue. Some more.
Oh, yes. It's quite ridiculous. But then you mentioned Jeffrey Rush, and I must admit, it's always great to see. I think he has made a couple of appearances, possibly in some smaller roles in the redeeming features movies we've looked at. But it's funny because Jeffrey Rush it's always easy to go the comic relief with him, but I think he almost understands the tone of the movie more than anyone else.
Yeah.
He sort of knows where he's coming from. Like, he's very camp in the way that he portrays it. He's very much a character actor, but I think he always almost seems like the one in on the joke. Not saying that this is intended to be a tongue-in-cheek type film, but he sort of lets it wash over without being as serious.
Yeah. All this convoluted dialogue is delivered so seriously, and then they'll throw in a little comic conversation every now and then, or a bit of you know, slapstick style action in amongst what is a movie which is largely taken very seriously, which I don't know if it gels with some of those performances, especially Gerard Butler hamming it up like no one's business.
But we're pretty much, you know, talking about the opening with that big scene with, you know, and it looks good to look at. Like, I can imagine this would have been quite good to see on the big screen, you know, even though the CGI would have been much more enhanced in that respect. But it was good seeing that opening scene. And God, Gerard Butler, as you said, you know, loving every minute of it, but he doesn't waste any time. I actually thought he was going to become the sort of comic relief, and maybe essentially he does because of his acting, but I thought he was going to become the comic relief character, because he sort of, but then he wasted no time in sort of taking over. And I mentioned before about Brian Brown, and it was sort of a bit of an underutilized sort of thing, but I am happy in a way they didn't spend so much time giving a bit of a backstory. They kind of didn't waste time getting into it to sort of start the plot.
Yeah, it definitely isn't a movie that wastes time getting things started. Once things are started, well, we can debate about how time goes, but I mean, like, yeah, we have this big opening, and it's obviously CGI. You know, I could live with that. I was handling that. I'm thinking, okay, it's okay. It looks a bit dodgy, but you know what? They're trying to create something here that really doesn't exist. That's okay. My begrudging acceptance of the CGI went out the window as soon as Set and Horus transformed into their full god wing creature type things to have their fight. I'm just going, that is some dodgy CGI right there. This is not good.
Fair enough. Like, you know, I can appreciate movies where you suspend disbelief and you can exist it happening in that universe. But yeah, when it's like that, it kind of takes you straight out of it. And it's really bad, because I did the mistake of reading before I watched the movie that it was filmed in Sydney. And and you know, in Fox Studios, and it was very hard then for me to not look at everything like they were in front of a green screen. And I hated that I was thinking like that. But you know, but yeah, as you said, with the CGI, but. The thing that actually lost me, Trevor, was probably the fact I can understand why they were getting at by doing this, but having Horus as tall as towering over the servants, you know how they had, and it happened throughout the movie, you know how the gods were essentially taller than the mortals, but and there was a few parts in the movie where that didn't quite work and was almost like made me laugh out loud. Let's just say.
I'll tell you what though, they went a great deal. I think this probably helps keep that. I think the movie was PG when it came out. The fact that the they set up very early that the gods bleed gold, and they had great attention to detail to show, you know, like when Brian Brown as Osiris got run through and he holds up his hand, it's covered with this golden liquid, and there's other times when I think even like there's a decapitation scene and gold sprays everywhere. But when one of the actual humans gets hurt, there's like no blood at all.
It's almost like they edited it out of what we're not going to show it. Unless it's gold, we're not showing it.
Yeah, there was a few occasions, I mean, we'll cover this in more detail, but when Zaya gets shot with the arrow, it's just like an arrow wound. Like, there's no blood around it at all. It's completely clean. There's just like a hole there. gold blood is fine. Real blood? Can't show that.
Yeah, no, definitely not. And, you know, it's almost like they had an M rating and then had to edit that out to try and get a bit of a wider audience. God. Anyway, not to ruin too much, but people subjected their children to this. But anyway. But one of the things, Trevor, because as I said, I found it really hard to sort of get into the story because of the effects and, you know, I suppose the over CGI. But I think once I started to realise that, yeah, this is essentially a mythology story, you know. But and it's sort of, it was more sort of filmed, more filmed as a storybook, you know, the sort of the garish colour and the kind of being out of place. Okay, it's more like watching a comic book adaptation or something. I don't know. I kind of let that take me over and I could accept a lot more. But yeah, a lot of it was quite strange, especially the fact that they're more transforming and, you know, like next thing, I think it was in that opening scene where they're all huddling and next thing, one of the gods that puts her, she gets her big bird wing out and covers them all. It's like, oh, that was very unexpected.
Yeah.
But yeah, so it took a while to get used to the transformations.
Early on, I could see they were going for, hey, we're going to treat this almost like a science fiction movie mixed in with mythology. I could see that they were trying to do this fresh take and like the when they transform, it's almost quite like a mechanical process as they change themselves into these dodgy CGI godlike beings, you know, with the appropriate heads for whatever character. But yeah, between having that, because I mean I had quite a fan of ancient history and the mythology of particularly like Egypt and Greece, so that I don't think having that sort of desire or that sort of interest helps a lot with a movie like this.
Because a lot of times they have to try and please the masses by making changes and things. Like one thing I noticed was the character, I think I'm getting it right, was Anubis, you know, the dog-like one that's the king of the underworld, isn't he? You know, and there was a couple of, I think it was him, and there was a couple of other characters where having them talk and sort of almost show teeth, it kind of took away the image that you have of these creatures, I suppose. I don't know, I can't explain it.
Yeah, no, I can't explain it. All the gods in their true god forms were bad CGI. I mean, that's as simple as that.
But another thing too, like we spoke about how, like, you know, like I do admit it would have looked gorgeous on the big screen, as I said, you know, because it's very colourful and bright. But I almost think that these stories are so dark that it maybe could have lent itself from being a darker film. And we could have got away with a bit more of the transformations without it being, you know, these really bright scenes with this jarring CGI almost.
Yeah, because it just all pops and stands out so much due to the brightness.
Oh, I was going to say, I hate saying it, but for 2016, you do. Yeah, you don't want to have that feeling with CGI, but that's probably the way that it's gone. I don't know. You expect something a bit more polished, perhaps, but not being a filmmaker, I can't really criticise.
Yeah. But it wasn't just the transformations. Like anytime someone was in a chariot or some sort of vehicle, and this is what happened when Beck and Xayah were escaping from Xayah's sinister, evil, sneering master, and they're running around the chariot. And it looked like, you know, it looks like one of those old shots where they used to have people in a car and have like a projection of what was happening behind them. Except this time the projection behind them was CGI, and it just stood out so much. I hate to think what that would look like on a big cinema screen, because just on the TV in front of me, I'm either going, they seriously thought that looked good? That looks terrible.
And a big problem, you know, a big problem with a character like Beck, who has long hair with locks or whatever, essentially, it doesn't quite work sometimes when you've got rear projection or whatever behind you, because you can sometimes make out the faint outline. So, yeah, I'm probably lucky I wasn't watching it on Blu-ray. Lucky I was watching the standard DVD. So, because, yeah, I think a lot of that would have been quite obvious.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't watching a HD copy, but I don't know if it was just upscaling or whatever on my system, but it was just like going, you what now? And then, but also had the convenient thing, because I mean that's a scene where Xayah gets shot with the arrow after her sinister slave master, who features quite prominently, unfortunately, further into the movie, that guy didn't do anything for me. Makes us...
And what is that actor? I've seen that actor before, and he usually plays the same kind of characters. But yeah, he seemed familiar, yeah. And yeah, I didn't like him either. I think that was the idea.
Yeah, the idea is you wouldn't like him. I just didn't really care about anything he said. But like, he makes this massive, massive long shot to get her right in the chest with an arrow. Yet when he fires at our hero, Beck, I still can't say that with a straight face, he completely misses. He's completely wide of the mark. So it's like, yeah, that's convenient. Obviously, you know, when you can't hit the hero, that's always a good thing.
You've got to keep him alive, you know, even though he just looked like a One Direction reject in a wig.
Yeah, anyway. Yeah.
Now, I must admit, we probably have moved on a little bit from it, but Trevor, I must admit, I did think of you when the enemies march into the coronation. They all do the Blues Brothers. Hop, 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 hop. I was thinking the whole time, I was cracking myself up going, what is that from? And then I remembered the Blues Brothers thing, and I couldn't keep a straight face.
Yeah, yeah. Because, yeah, you know, having Horus blow this horn, I mean, there was no way that was going to go bad for him.
Definitely not. Again, the way they were speaking with that, I'm going to, yeah, that wasn't the dialogue, but, you know, pretty much I'm going to go and blow this, you know. But, yeah, again, the modern feeling going with that whole ancient Egypt, it just sort of didn't work.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, God. Sorry. I'm just
we're all over the place, Trevor. That's probably why. But
I'm just thinking about these Egyptian soldiers descending on ropes going, hut, 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 now. You completely throw me, of course.
Sorry about that, but I should have told you earlier. It would have made you appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I wish I had thought of that myself. I think I was just too busy going, what am I watching?
But one thing I did sort of get as soon as we sort of had the whole Beck sort of after, you know, after we've got that opening scene essentially, and he's trying to save Xayah from slavery, but sort of essentially became what I felt like a live action Aladdin, what I could imagine Disney doing with that sort of thing, especially with his sort of character. But I did like when he had to work his way through all the traps to get Horus's eye. Like, you know, I wanted more cool things like that, more kind of, I wanted essentially more of a quest or a road movie without cutting back to a lot of, I don't know, Gerard Butler.
Yeah, yeah. Less Gerard Butler, more traps and fun action scenes. Mind you,
I kind of appreciate that stuff. Sorry.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, he got through the traps. You know, it was such a big thing and such a big scene. Tell you what, though, he managed. Even though we last saw him as he gets the Eye of Horus and falls on the ground, and we see him holding the eye up to hold the scorpions at bay. Next scene, he apparently got out fine. You know, there's so all he went through to get in there, and it was apparently trapped down the bottom of this great pit with no apparent way out. He just got out. That's fine. Yeah.
We've got to move on. We've only got 2 hours to tell this story.
Yeah, we do indeed.
But I almost expected, in how we said the dialogue was almost sort of witty one-liners, but it's funny, you half expected him to go, oh, what? Only one eye? Like a real, I went through all that.
Oh, we kind of get Horus with that going, what? Where's my other eye? You know, this stuff. Yeah.
But that was the funny thing I was going to ask you, Trevor. It was hard to sort of know, like, obviously we saw the changeover of Set taking over and being the god and then building this huge, very modern-looking building. Mm. And I was sort of wondering how much time is supposed to have passed, because it's almost like when Beck makes his way in to give Horus the eye, it's almost like, yeah, I've been waiting 5 minutes. Oh, cool, let's go. Hasn't changed one bit.
Yeah. I mean, there is no real indication of how long it's been. It's just like Set takes over and then it's like a indeterminate time later, everyone's pushing giant blocks around and they've built this giant tower to the sky in honor of Ra.
And then I'm like, oh, it's not big, it's not tall enough. What do you mean?
Just joking.
Again, would you have said that in ancient Egypt? Just joking. No. But anyway.
I almost think that I mean, that if that sort of performance is what Jared Butler was going to, I think this probably would have been better served with Brian Blessed in that role, because he can actually pull that off.
Oh, yeah. And I think he's made a couple of appearances on redeeming features for us.
He has indeed.
Maybe Gerard spent too much time working out than restraining his performance, perhaps.
Yeah, I don't know. He was having fun, at least. At least he was having fun. Yeah. Someone was having fun, and that someone was Gerard Butler.
But the problem with movies like this is when everyone does take it a bit too seriously, but I don't know how it would have come across as a camp movie anyway if they'd gone another sort of angle. But being the fact that this is based on mythology, and that's the thing I was saying earlier, I kind of had to rack my brains in my sort of ancient history knowledge, but I'm assuming they'd got the mythology quite right. I don't know. They probably took a lot of artistic license.
I don't know. I actually have a friend who is a qualified Egyptologist, but I'm scared to ask her.
She'd be like, no, get away from me. Do not mention that movie.
I'm pretty sure a number of liberties were taken.
Yes, I'm sure. Anything to get bums on seats, I suppose, and just enough by the sounds of it.
but yeah, I tell you what, one thing that I found did work, because we've been really ragging on this so far, so I better talk about the stuff that worked. I mean, after Zaya got shot and Zaya dies, and I'm thinking, who's the love interest now? We get the shot of her being taken by Anubis to the underworld, the afterlife. And I think because the afterlife was so dark and dusty and, you know, everything was obscured, that worked for me. The shots as we go through the movie, we get to have little brief visits back with her, making her journey along the path to the Gates of Judgment or whatever. And I thought those bits, they looked good. I didn't actually like seeing when I went to that, because, you know, you didn't have this garish colour to make the CGI stand out like a sore thumb. So that's something that worked for me. God. Yeah.
Well, Trevor, I'm sitting here nodding my head going, I thought exactly the same. I really loved the way that they sort of depicted the afterlife. And I loved that shot where they're all walking towards that big boat, because I think there was a lot of sort of, what do they call it, hieroglyphics that showed Anubis on a boat with all the, you know, almost leading these people to the afterlife. Yeah, and I felt it was quite good. And you know how we'd said it would have been probably better as a darker film. Maybe they really wanted to show the difference between the afterlife and that. But yeah, those shots really worked for me.
Yeah, I mean, they did try to, I suppose, make the main world progressively darker. I suppose that's something that happens throughout the movie, is as we got further through, you know, when they had shots back at the main city, you know, things were getting progressively darker as the movie moved on, but you still had these just stick out like a sore thumb, vibrant people and vibrant CGI creatures sticking out against the background. So you're going, yeah, that's
it doesn't quite
yeah.
work.
Because I couldn't get past the CGI most of the time. So that's why I really did appreciate the afterlife shots.
Yeah, I was the same too. Like, I think those really bright, yeah, it just becomes a bit too obvious. But one part I did really appreciate was the part with the killer snakes. Well, I suppose that's what you call them. I actually found them quite terrifying. Like, in terms of, like, you know, obviously they're CGI. But yeah, like, it really worked. And like I was saying earlier, I wish that the movie had been more about him trying to overcome obstacles like that. Essentially like a road movie. you know, and without cutting back to a lot of this other sort of stuff to flesh it out a bit more. But yeah, I really quite liked that. It was essentially a chase scene, but and I love the fact that the I can't remember the character that did it. I think it was the other girl that he was with. Essentially made the snake kill itself because the to kill the girl that was riding on it. I love how it just sort of like shoots fire the entire way up its body. I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, yeah. When the goddess of love turns up and seduces the snake to do her bidding. Yeah, I mean, slightly creepy on a bestiality level, but still effective.
Yes. But those characters were scary. But like, even though they were snakes, I've got a phobia of lizards, so they kind of reminded me a bit of that. So yeah, that's probably where it came from. So
yeah.
But
that was probably one of the more enjoyable action scenes, probably because they didn't have any of the human characters transforming into something dodgy.
Oh, I
think that helped.
Yeah, and it was always transforming into something. I've got a note here later on, but a lot of times, I think when he ends up turning into a super beast a bit later on, I end up looking more like Iron Man than anything else. But oh, look, I've got this quote written down, and I can't remember what part it was from. I think it might have been the part where they're on their trek, and that, you know, when he throws out the water and he's carrying her through the water. I think it might have been around that, but there's a quote where she says, "Isn't this a bit excessive?" And I'm like, "Love, you've just summed up the entire movie." And I thought, that's interesting. Isn't this a bit excessive?
Mm-hmm.
Again, I don't know if they would have been saying that. I think that was around the time of get off your ass and get me some water.
quite possibly. A lot of the, I suppose, to use your term, the road movie shots really are just them walking through different scenery, having their witty banter, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, it's hard to know, especially when he tips out all the water and it's very anti-feminist, this movie, when you think about it. Like, you know, for 2016, yes, it's not showing women in a very good light, which is not too good, you know, and which I, you know, obviously I can understand that possibly they're being historical, but it didn't come across well in a lot of scenes, especially with that sort of stuff as well. Like, so shown as this woman, why are you wearing that? You know, like, why are you wearing that dress, you know? And you're like, dude, I was ruling the country before. Yeah. You know, I didn't expect to be traipsing through mud.
Very, very much so. And, yeah, like, you know, her power is to just look at someone and seduce him with her beauty, except for Beck, because Beck's heart already belongs to someone. So, yeah. That was a convenient plot hole.
You can't help but kind of shudder when you think about that as being what the basis of a lot of it is.
But yeah, like, you know, they had this constant movement, constant things. There was running and jumping. I mean, the fight scene with the snakes was quite good, but I was really watching this movie just going, I know, lots is happening, lots of action, but I just still don't care about any of these people. So, yeah, next.
Yeah, and that's the biggest problem with a lot of the movies that we've looked at, you know, where we have sort of, I suppose, criticized them. It's having that sort of human interest story, or having essentially not just this thin plot, which is what this is. And I'm almost baffled that it became a 2-hour and 7-minute movie, considering, as you said, that we weren't really given much in the way of character development.
Very, very true. But I'll tell you what, one character when he turned up who I did kind of enjoy. Was when we got, I suppose, the principal non-Caucasian actor of the music of the movie,
yes.
Chadwick Boseman, turned up, and they go to his temple, and there's just like he may have been the only person of color in the main cast, but at least they made sure there was a whole lot of him.
Yeah, definitely. Oh gosh, I really enjoyed that scene, Trevor.
Yeah.
It kind of seemed like a real welcomed scene, and it was still had that. It had humor that wasn't forced.
Yeah.
Too. Like, I can't remember what line it was when he, what was the line where he looks around or something and goes, you know, well, that's not true, is it? And they don't look. I can't remember what it was, but they, you know, they actually had attempt at humor in there and it worked. It was kind of a welcome diversion, that scene, I think.
It was. Until you realized a bit later on that Chadwick Boseman never dropped that one-note character.
Yeah, but that could have also been the way he was directed as well. I don't know.
Potentially, yeah. I have questions about the direction in this movie on a number of levels.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. God, the direction of the CGI is probably a big question on mine. You know, and I hate being critical like that. You know, I hate, we wouldn't be doing the redeeming features, would we, if we hated criticizing movies? But, you know, like, like it's the problem when it's they don't match. And I don't know. Obviously, we're going all over the place, so I don't really know where we're sort of up to. But there was a one that really didn't work for me was, you know, I mentioned that, you know, Horus or the gods were bigger than the mortals. There was a scene where Horus carries Beck sort of under his arm, and it was literally laughable. I was trying to work out how they bloody filmed it. They probably weren't in the same room when both of them did it.
Yeah, pretty much.
And also, yeah, it was just, yeah, you just couldn't get past things like that without literally lolling.
Yeah, exactly right. Anytime they actually had to rely on really rely on the CGI, it was just so, it just seemed so forced, and it just stood out so much against the green screen that 99% of this movie was filmed in front of. You see, going, okay, dokie.
And especially, like I mentioned earlier, that, you know, a lot of it was filmed in Centennial Park, I think that's called, in Sydney. And there was that shot, you know, actually just before they went and get the water, they're kind of in that greenery sort of area. And I'm like, well, at least that little patch they were on would have been it. Mm-hmm. The rest is all been added in afterwards. So I can pretty much imagine these actors having performed for about 12 months in front of a green screen and nothing else.
Yeah, pretty much. Oh dear, we should probably stop focusing on the CGI, or else we're not going to get anywhere.
Yes, because anyway, it's hard. It is hard to ignore.
It is very hard, very very difficult to ignore. But one thing, like I think they left hanging for too long is when the love goddess, who I can't remember either the name or the character, or the actress at all. It's just gone. but when she, because we find out they have a rather forced expositional dialogue to say, oh, look, that bracelet around her neck is the only thing saving her from a bunch of demons because she escaped the underworld at some point. And of course, when they, because of Set's rule, people can only get to the nice afterlife if they've got a lot of gold or a lot of treasure that they can give at the gates of judgment. And of course, poor Zaya, she died with nothing. She only had a smile for Anubis. That was all she had. So when she decides to do the sacrifice herself so that her bracelet can be delivered to Zaya, and which brings everyone closer together, it was like he goes down there, goes to hand her the bracelet, and then there's like 20 odd minutes of just stuff happening above ground. He's going, so what happened with the gift? What's going on down there? As Ra is apparently killed by Set, and this giant worm thing that Ra is fighting is descending upon the countryside, is the people that were actually meant to care about Beck and Zaya, are they okay? What's going on?
I know, and then they do suddenly come back to the whole what I call the weighing scene, I suppose. Yeah, where they're doing all that, but actually, we're talking about the afterlife scenes, and I must admit, I did also like that, the whole stepping up and having to have your, you know, whatever jewels or whatever you have be weighed. I thought that was a kind of clever concept. So, but that's me digressing again. But yeah, it was very. And, oh, I thought you were going to say it's funny how they stopped for about 20 minutes and had to see if their hands didn't touch each other. Did you notice how they had to stop and do that a few times?
Yeah. So I was like,
oh my God, I can't touch you.
Yeah, we.
Okay, cool, move on.
Yeah, we got it the first time. You don't need to repeat it three times to get the point across.
Yeah. Meanwhile, I think when she first stepped up to the scales and she didn't answer straight away, he's like, hurry up. He's like, yep, when they stand there for 20 seconds doing the whole hand thing, no one says anything about rushing.
No. Oh, hang on, they're having a moment. Let's just wait.
Just let it be.
can't interrupt the main couple of the movie. Who, oh, will they ever get back together? We don't know. Anyway, I'll get back to that.
That have as much chemistry as sandpaper and a piece of cheese. But anyway.
Yeah, there was no chemistry in this movie at all. Everyone, I think, was so focused on their one-note characters that they couldn't have room for actual convincing relationships.
Well, that's what made me think when you first said about the Razzies and it said, you know, any two people on screen, I actually thought it was going to be at first a reference to the two, I suppose, leads or the love interest in inverted commas because, yeah, it was very much the case with those two.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's always a problem when right from the outset the leads don't have chemistry. I just never a good start.
Yeah. And I think possibly a bad thing was probably casting virtually unknown leads when you've sort of only got, well, I don't know, Gerard Butler, but I mean, like, you know, sort of Jeffrey Rush or iconic people that you're sort of seeing, oh, yeah. But then maybe they were a bit worried about putting more famous people in these parts. I don't know. Or maybe they knew how the film was going to turn out. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I want to know what some of the decisions leading up to this movie were. But I think we're giving starting to give too much away. Anyway.
Oh, I know. I just realized that. I'm going to rein myself in. But I think we might have given a bit of indication about that before.
Now. Yeah. Yeah. If people haven't got an idea where this is going yet, then I have no comment about that. But, I mean, another interesting thing was, I suppose, how set. We had to go back to Seth from time to time to see him being bad, and how he was being bad was basically taking bits from other Egyptian gods. Like he took the wings from his ex-wife, and there was a comment saying that no one could find Osiris's heart. I wonder who's got it. And the other eye of Horus, and he, at one point he pulls out Chadwick Boseman's brain. And then they show this thing, this very, very industrial type scene where, like, the stuff is being basically welded to him in bits, and he becomes this, you know, this super god or whatever with all this parts. I suppose you could say, at that point, he had the whole set. Yes, I've been waiting the entire podcast to do that joke.
To be able to say that. Well, that's another thing that, like I said earlier, that reminded me so much of almost like Iron Man getting into his outfit or something. It just seemed, it didn't seem to fit with the rest of the film, even though by now you'd kind of let a lot of things just slide.
yeah. And then, like, you know, he's had all the stuff, he's got all the power, he's got the Staff of Ra and this giant worm thing descends down to Earth and starts doing whatever it's doing. It didn't seem to actually do any permanent damage because everything seemed fine after everything was resolved. But it's just, he's just standing there thinking, okay, so what, he's going to let that thing eat the world now? What's going on? He's just going to stand on top of his giant obelisk and gloat at the world while it gets consumed? What's going on? I don't understand your motivation here, Set.
Well, that's the thing. I didn't quite understand that whole, that whole worm thing in the sky. It took me a while to sort of realize what actually is that supposed to be? But yeah, I know it was almost like, devouring the world, sort of like, I don't know if you remember the thing called the Langoliers in the 90s.
Oh, God.
With Stephen King. It just reminded me of that. But anyway, by now we weren't questioning too many things. It was just kind of happening.
Yeah, it was just like this giant oval of toothiness, largely disguised by black clouds. And you're going, all right, that's a thing. That's a thing they've put in the movie for plot reasons. Is anything going to happen? Not yet? Okay, I'll wait.
And it's like almost to give it some sort of the climactic finale or the final battle, which just didn't seem to quite live up to anything, especially with, sorry to mention it again, the CGI again. It's just so hard to relate to this sort of stuff when the final scene is computer generated.
I mean, I suppose the big final battle was really the CGI bird battle between Set and Horus that went on too long and was bad CGI because it was them in their CGI bird outfits with a few shots of Horus standing there with just his head transformed back into the actor. Because, again, putting CGI bodies on underneath people's actual faces, it doesn't work, guys.
The problem with it, it's just so hard to relate to it. I know what we're seeing on screen is something that wouldn't exist in, you know, real life as such, but still, hey, there's got to be a way. I think I probably would have preferred to see them in bird costumes. I would have probably felt something a bit more, but it just sort of gives you that whole disconnect. You sort of get taken out straight away when you see things like that. I think there's been a couple of movies we've spoken about where they've done final scenes like this, and it just, it doesn't work. But one thing I did appreciate about the final battle, it was good to see them happening on the pyramids. Like, it was good, I don't know, it was just good to see that sort of iconic imagery, I suppose. But that's pretty much where it ended.
Yeah. I mean, definitely. The time when it did actually look like ancient Egypt, those bits looked good. When it was everything else, you're going, okay, dokie. But again, back to the blood thing. I mean, at the end, when Horus is defeating Set and Gerard Butler's lying there in a pool of seeping gold spreading out around him. He's going, okay. And yet still, when a human gets cut, there's just like a red line across their arm. This guy is obviously bleeding gold out of every orifice, but that's fine. That's fine. We can put that in a PG movie.
Or like that part earlier where it made me laugh, where one of the guys that looked like Anubis, but one of the sort of beasts or whatever that's in his arm, he comes over and he's bleeding and he's holding and he goes, I'd get that looked at if I were you. I'm like, oh, God, again, would they have said that?
yeah, again, dialogue just ranges between over-the-top dramatic and underwhelmingly cheesy.
I get the feeling the people writing this did not study their hieroglyphics beforehand.
I think the people writing this just went, wouldn't it be cool if we had a movie about ancient Egyptian gods but made it all sci-fi-y? I mean, Ra practically stands on a giant spaceship in orbit that tows the sun.
And that was like, you mentioned the science fiction film feel, I suppose. But yeah, whenever they did those shots where it was sort of space and something, I'm like, what the hell? Where are we now? Like, oh yeah, it just didn't quite work.
Yeah, I could see what they were going for. I suppose I have to give them some credit for what they were intending. But I think I'm just wondering, because obviously a lot of that budget went to the CGI effects. So I'm just thinking that some of the choices they made in the CGI were, questionable.
Or they did them and didn't expect them to be so jarring on the big screen, perhaps. Yeah,
indeed. And but of course, mentioning the big worm after Gerard Butler gets glitched, and Horace flies back into orbit where Jeffrey Rush is just like floating around. because he's not dead. Oh, look at that. As soon as he gets his scepter back, he's down to earth and zaps the worm away to save the day.
Aww.
And then because Horus can't do it, Ra comes along and brings our hero and his love interest back to life. Aww.
And it's funny because I think at one stage Horace goes, I should make you god of the impossible. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, God. Because when the next shot becomes the coronation, sort of like the opening scene, I'm like, oh, please don't be turning him into the god of the impossible. It didn't work. But then I was kind of, even though he, you know, wasn't necessarily an out there kind of character as such, but Beck, I kind of expected him to get more than just the advisor. But I suppose when Horace leaves, he gets to look after the land in his absence. But yeah, I kind of expected him to give him a bigger role.
Yeah, he's like his chief advisor or something that gets announced.
It just felt underwhelming.
Yeah, but then I don't know if the implication was that, because, you know, Horace is saying he's going away for a few days, but, you know, I don't know where I got it from. I just got this indication that they're all trying to set up that Beck then becomes the first human king of Egypt or something after Horus fixes things up, and instead of gold getting you into the afterlife, it becomes, you know, the deeds you've done, which ties in more with Egyptian mythology, because the whole thing about the gates of the afterlife in Egyptian mythology is that you weigh your heart against a feather, and, like, you know, the more good deeds you've done, the lighter your heart is, and the more likely you are to get through to the good afterlife and not be thrown down to the Eater of Souls. Just for a bit of nerd mythology history for you there.
but I appreciated the fact that they did, you know, it kind of had not a happy ending. I'm not normally into sort of morality tales, but I did like how at the end he kind of changed it. So yeah, it was more sort of how you were in life, to sort of how it, you know, happened in the afterlife. So I kind of did appreciate that part of it.
Yeah. I mean, definitely. Like I said, that definitely brought it more into actual, closer to real Egyptian mythology. But yeah, like I said, the implication of Horus saying, I'll just be gone for a few days, really probably means that Horus left and basically left the humans in charge. And that's how humans got to rule Egypt instead of the gods. Yeah, I don't know. That's the impression I got.
Interesting way. We might have to wait for Gods of Egypt 2 to see what happens next. Too soon.
too soon. Way too soon. My scar's still bleeding gold from it. I think I gave too much away there.
I love the fact that you've brought in at least a reference to the gold.
Just in case you forgot, I did notice at the end of the 10 minutes of credits, it gives you the name of the movie again in big letters across the screen.
And you don't see that too often as somebody who screens movies and always has to watch to the end of the credits. You don't see it too often. It's usually the Dolby Digital and finished. But yeah, it was quite different. But one thing that stood out to me in the credits was, God, how many people worked on this bloody movie? It just seemed like so many of the chunks were just like, this part operators. Oh, a list of 300 names. I think that's hence the reason why they were 10-minute credits.
Yeah, it was every... I think everyone who breathed in the general direction of this movie showed up.
Well, there was a little section there for everyone who paid to come and see the movie, a list of about 5 names. But I'm thinking, hang on, that couldn't be right. They made $140 million. People did see this movie.
Yeah, they absolutely did. So, that's got us to the final credits. Were there any other parts of the movie that you wanted to have a chat about, or do you think we've covered them?
Oh,
well?
Probably not, without giving too much more away. And I think if I did have some more criticism or comments, it'd be CGI related. So I definitely think we've touched on enough.
Excellent. Well, it's that time. So I did pick this movie, Christian. So as per tradition, what are your thoughts on the redeemability of Gods of Egypt?
Now, I do admit my redeeming features section of the podcast is always a bit brief, and I probably should have thought about it a bit more, and I'm sure our thoughts are probably known by a lot of what we said, but I found for this movie, it's easy for me to go, it's not my kind of thing. I'm not really a sword and sandal epic person, if we want to lump it into that category, but I can appreciate that this movie would have looked quite good on the big screen. If not, I suppose a lot of that CGI wouldn't have worked as such, but it would have lent itself, especially in a lot of those sort of landscape scenes. So it's good to look at, but unfortunately the problem is when you look at a movie in the fact of how good it is to look at it, it's a bit of a shame because it usually means elsewhere it doesn't have much substance, and that's probably where this movie is. I could not get past the essential green screen or CGI. I just felt that everything they were doing was just these actors standing in costumes with a fake background, And at a film that's clocking in at quite an overlong 2 hours and 7 minutes, you want something that's going to grab you a bit more and be a bit more of an adventure. And as I said before, I would have preferred this to be more of a road movie or a quest movie, more in the spirit of maybe Indiana Jones, him going through a lot of obstacles to try and sort of to get there without having to cut back to a lot of subplots or overacting. So, for 2016, I actually found some of this movie quite laughable and kind of find it hard to believe this came out only last year. So it did have some comic moments, but I think perhaps if those sort of tongue-in-cheek, if that vibe had continued, I think it probably would have worked for the whole movie. I don't know. But Trevor, it's a hard one. I think our thoughts are known, but not my kind of movie, and I definitely would never watch it again. But I have to say it's irredeemable. Can't redeem this movie.
Fair enough. Well, onto my thoughts. Look, this movie may have had a blockbuster budget, but to me it seemed to have more like a dodgy TV show production mentality, leading it to be a 2-hour action-adventure soap opera. The dialogue was awful, the characters were overblown while still being one note, which is quite an achievement, and the acting itself I found ranged from wooden to hammy. I will give it a nod for Jeffrey Rush as a bit of a standout, but probably only due to him being a better actor than the other people involved in this movie. Look, I never really felt engaged with this movie. It was probably the biggest thing. The action was so bad and was so heavy with bad CGI, and most of the scenes were set up for like obviously trying to deliver some sort of a wow factor that never actually delivered. The only CGI was when things got dusty and murky in the underworld. That worked because it just didn't stand out. And really, at the end of the day, it's clear that not even the gods can save this one from being completely irredeemable. This movie is trash. I'm sorry for making you watch it. Please accept my apologies.
Oh, no worries, Trevor. I think the fact that we both subjected ourselves to it and we both thought the same. But yeah, I did forget to say in my sum up, the afterlife scenes were good. But yeah, you need more than that to sustain a 2.5 I mean, it's 2-hour and 7-minute movie.
Absolutely. So that's a big, definite, irredeemable of Gods of Egypt from 2016. I broke our run. Sorry about that. But this movie does have fans, believe it or not. And so,
whoa.
Is this the Redeeming Features podcast? So I do like to finish with some form of redeemability. So this is a review from Amazon titled, I recommend this one very much. Tomb Raider meets Stargate in an Egyptian mythology setting. Absolute genius. First off, I would have to say that this is not your run-of-the-mill Egyptian mythology redo. This is a bona fide original masterpiece that is as unique as it is thrilling. That is not to say that there are tiny bits of cheesiness, but I found it to be very compelling. All-star cast and amazing CGI fight scenes with comedy, suspense, and romance. 5 stars.
I think I'm more baffled that they used the quote, bona fide original masterpiece for a review of this film. Everyone's entitled to their own opinion, but that one, that one scares me.
The amazing CGI comment scares me. But you know what? If this movie has fans and if this movie has people out there that enjoy it, all good to them. I don't begrudge anyone for enjoying a movie, no matter how wrong they are for enjoying it.
And hey, it's got to have fans, because that means we don't have to be the fans of the movie.
We just have to watch it, though. It's just all good.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, Christian, well, from that, I guess we need to discuss what we might look at next. Are we going to be able to step up from the ruins of the gods of Egypt into something a bit more redeemable? It's up to you.
Look, this is a hard one, Trevor. There's always got to be some explanation with me with the next movie. But look, let's just say you took me into Gods of Egypt territory, and I thought, that's given me a bit of leverage, you realise. We've got an over 2-hour movie here. I think it's time for me to revisit a film that I did appreciate a lot when it came out, and you know, I have seen it a few times over the years. But as we always say, watching it with the Redeeming Features hat on is always very different. Now, Trevor, I don't know how you're going to go with this. We are going back into a musical territory, which wasn't expected, but this is a movie I decided last week I wanted to revisit because it's just been announced that they're mounting a new Australian production of this musical. It's going to tour next year with Tina Arena in the lead role. So this movie came out in 1996. It features somebody who's been on the Redeeming Features a couple of times and probably not noted very much for being a good actress, let's just say.
Okay.
This movie received a lot of Golden Globes. It was an adaptation of an Andrew Lloyd Webber musical. It was very popular when it came and went. I mean, sorry, it was very popular when it came out. It did come and go. And unfortunately, Trevor, it is political. It is 1996's Evita, starring Madonna.
Oh, we're going back to Madonna. She has not had a good run on the Redeeming Features cast.
Hasn't had a good run at all. So I thought with the Australian production of Evita touring next year, I thought it's probably time to look at the 1996 completely sung 2-hour movie.
Absolutely. I have seen it. I saw it quite some time ago. I do remember enjoying Antonio Banderas' performance in this movie, but yeah, I haven't really felt compelled to go back to it. So I'm certainly keen to give Evita from 1996 a go. Now, if anybody out there wants to check out Evita, I've just had a quick look and it is available across most of the digital stores here in Australia. It's on Dendy Direct, it's on Apple iTunes, Google Play, the Microsoft Store, and a new one. Apparently there's a Q store. I don't know what that's for. I need to look up. There's another streaming service here listed. Oh, well.
Oh, well, our Q store users will be happy.
They will be, and we'll have to find out what that is to see if it's worthwhile. So definitely, if you want to check out Evita before the next podcast, you've got plenty of options out there, and I'm sure overseas listeners will have a lot more than what we have here in Australia, which is generally how it is. Australians have accepted that, but we're slowly catching up.
We are the convict country.
Yeah, well, you know.
We're used to getting the bad end of the deal. Oh, but so yeah, so I didn't think we'd be going from Sword and Sandal to Argentinian political musical. So yeah, it's been a big jump.
That is quite the jump, and one I am happy to take. Now, of course, if anyone out there would like to get in touch, do you think we've been too harsh on Gods of Egypt? Do you think we've been too generous and this movie should be unfilmed, like our first review said? Let us know. Do you have any redeeming features or otherwise for Evita from 1996? Or do you just want to say hi or even suggest a movie to us? We're definitely happy to hear that. You can get in touch with us by heading to our homepage, wrong podcast.
It's good that you're automatically thinking.
Yes, yes. You can get in touch with us by heading to our homepage at rufusproject.com. You can send us an email to podcast@rufusproject.com, or you can find the Rufus Project quite easily on Twitter or Facebook and get in touch with us there. We would definitely love to hear from you.
Definitely, and I thoroughly recommend the What the History podcast. It's our sister podcast, but yeah, one end of the scale to the other, pretty much, from bad movies to historical tidbits.
Absolutely. So that's moving into the plugs there quite quickly. So yep, if you want to hear some bizarre bits of history to make you say What the History, that's a podcast I do with my wife Susie every fortnight, and that's at wthpod.rufusproject.com. Speaking of plugs and all sorts of fun things, Christian, I understand you've got a few things coming up in the Brisbane area that people may want to attend and enjoy.
Oh, definitely. There's no rest for me. I know, I was going to say ours truly, or I don't know if that's the way we say it, but Trevor and myself will be appearing in a certain floor show for an iconic cult movie, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, on the 22nd of September. Trevor, we have 50 tickets left.
Whoa.
Wow, we've hit after doing the floor show for about 17 years, it's probably bigger than ever before, so definitely get along and experience the Rocky Horror Picture Show the way it should be at the Chanel Theatre on the 22nd of September. So many other cult movies. We've got Troll 2 and Mac and Me, two movies actually that we've mentioned on the redeeming features. And Trevor, it's selling so well. I'm a bit worried about Brisbane audiences sometimes. Actually, that reminds me. So check out Troll 2 and Mac and Me on the big screen, but maybe have a listen to the podcast first. Maybe actually do it around the other way so you actually come to the screen.
Hey, I think we...
That might be a good idea.
I think we managed to redeem Mac and Me just because it was so bizarrely outrageously fun.
I'm really hoping Paul Rudd just turns up, but that's probably wishful thinking. But so yeah, many screenings coming up, a lot of things at Metro Arts, a lot of 80s movies which are selling quite well. So I'd give a list right now, but there's so many. So head to Christian Fletcher with a K, K-R, christianfletcher.com. And all my list of upcoming events are on there.
Absolutely, definitely worth checking out. And if you are thinking about coming to the Rocky Horror Floor Show in September, the last two times we did this, it did completely sell out. So, yeah, it's doing very well. It's very popular, and it's definitely worth checking out. I'm saying that as a Rocky Horror fan, as well as someone who's obviously interested being in the floor show itself. Lots and lots of fun. So, on that note, I think it's time to wrap this up. Okay, the movie may not have been redeemable, but I've really enjoyed chatting Gods of Egypt with you, Christian.
Oh, definitely. I was going to say I'd rather watch the podcast. I don't know how that would happen, but we might have to look at doing a video one time.
Yeah, yeah.
But definitely, always enjoy the chat. So, yeah, looking forward to seeing how we go with Evita, but looking forward to revisiting that movie again too. So always, always fantastic cover.
Absolutely. So we'll be back in a couple of weeks' time to chat Evita from 1996, see if we can get a redeemable Madonna movie on the list, considering the last time we did a Madonna movie, it was so bad I felt like I needed to have a shower. So we can only go up from there.
On that note...
Oh, I feel creepy just saying it now. Ugh. Anyway, let's move on quickly, and we'll be back in a couple of weeks' time to chat Evita and see if we can redeem it. So see you then.
She came from nothing.
I am only a simple woman.
But she wanted everything. She rose to power on the strength of her passion.
When the crowd sings.
Hollywood Pictures presents the story of a love between a girl and a dream, between an actress and a politician, between a country and a legend. Madonna, Antonio Banderas, Jonathan Pryce, in a film directed by Alan Parker, with music by Andrew Lloyd Webber and lyrics by Tim Rice.
Creatures, but we want to know what the redeeming features.
Boy? Oh boy.
Christian and Trevor on the case, watching movies from all over the place. I'm the bee, says it's bad, but we want to know, is it fun to be had?
Boy? Oh boy.
Redeeming features.
Egyptian.